This is Audible.
Harper One and Harper Audio present Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends on It by Kamal Ravikant. This is the author. To James, Christine, Sajid, Sal, Sydney, and Gideon, you made this book happen. Thank you. Why listen to this book? I almost didn't publish Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends on It. I was terrified. Here I was, a CEO who had fallen apart after his company failed, writing a book about how loving himself saved him. I thought I'd be a laughingstock and my career would be finished. But I stepped through the fears and shared my truth with the world. What happened next changed my life. The book went viral. Amazing people all over shared it online and on social media. They bought copies for friends and family. They wrote heartfelt reviews. For some, this book literally saved their lives. For others, it was the first time they ever loved themselves. To think how close I was to giving in to my fears. An important life lesson. Many readers reached out and showed me how they'd applied it. They asked questions. This taught me that, despite its success, what I shared wasn't enough. To create lasting impact, I had to go deeper and share a lot more. I owed it to this book. I owed it to everyone who would read it. So, 7 years after I first put it out, here it is. All the questions I received, resolved. My intention is that by the time you finish, not only will you be committed to loving yourself, you'll know exactly how to do it, and most importantly, how to make it last. Part one, The Vow, is the original version. Expanded. What I wish someone had given me when I was at bottom. No fluff, no nonsense. Just simple and practical truth. You can read it and transform your life. Part two, the manual, is new. It lays out the process I've refined over the years to love myself. Then, it shows you how to take it to the next level. Everything here is easy and effective. In a nutshell, it's a step-by-step guide on how to love yourself. Another thing I wish someone had given me. Part three, the lesson, also new, is a record of a time when I fell hard. It bears how I applied everything in this book to heal and then rise. You'll see my inner and outer journey, what I did right, and the mistakes I made. Since we often learn best from stories, experiencing my transformation will help you create your own. I separate my life into before I vow to love myself and after. I cannot think of a better way to live. Please try it. It works. Part 1. The Vow. How it started. In December of 2011, I was a participant at Renaissance Weekend in Charleston, South Carolina. Not what you think. No jousting knights or fair maidens. Instead, a conference attended by CEOs from Silicon Valley and New York, Hollywood types from LA, and politicians and their staff from DC. It's like TED, but everyone is assigned to participate in panels or give a talk. The application asks for awards won and recognitions received, and as an example, listed the Nobel Prize. Really. I have no awards to speak of, or pedigree. No Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley on my business card. When the founder of the event introduced me to the audience at a talk I gave, the topic assigned to me, if I could do anything, he said, "Kamal cannot keep still." Whether as an infantry soldier in the U.S. Army, or climbing the Himalayas, or walking across Spain on an ancient pilgrimage, he's always moving. He'd done his research. I don't remember the rest, but I remember his last line. I'm sure he'll have something interesting to share with us. I had exactly 2 minutes to stand on a podium and address an audience of scientists, Pentagon officials, politicians, and CEOs, all far more qualified than I to talk about pretty much anything. The speaker before me had been the youngest person to graduate from MIT. Full honors, of course. It's interesting what goes through your mind at moments like these. Time slows down, yes, but that's almost cliche. There's only the podium and the microphone. You step up. The audience grows blurry, as if out of focus. Clock starts. And then I knew what to do. I would offer something no one else could. My truth. Something I learned purely from my experience. Something that saved me. The audience came into focus. If I could do anything, I said into the microphone, I would share the secret of life with the world. Laughter from the audience. And I just figured it out a few months ago. For the next 2 minutes, I spoke about the previous summer when I'd been very sick, practically on bed rest. The company I'd built from scratch 4 years ago had failed. I'd just gone through a breakup, and a friend I loved suddenly died. To say I was depressed, I said, would have been a good day. I told him about the night I was up late, surfing Facebook, looking at photos of my friend who'd passed, and I was crying, miserable, missing her. I told him about waking up next morning, unwilling to take it anymore, the vow I made, and how it changed everything. Within days, I started to get better, physically, emotionally. But what surprised me was that life got better on its own. Within a month, my life had transformed, the only constant being the vow I'd made to myself and how I kept it. Afterward, and for the rest of the conference, people came up individually and told me how much what I'd shared meant to them. One woman told me that sitting in the audience, listening to me, she'd realized that this was the reason she came. All I'd done was share a truth I learned. A month later, a friend was going through a difficult time, so I quickly wrote up what I'd done that summer and sent it to him. It helped him a lot. Months after, I shared it in an email with James Altucher, a dear friend and my favorite blogger. He replied, offering to feature it as a guest post on his blog. Naturally, I refused. Truth be told, I panicked. Lots of my friends read his blog. I'm an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. It's fine to write about startups, but this stuff? You have to, James wrote back. This is the only message that's important. I shared my fear with him. What would people think? His response, something that I will never forget and will always be grateful for. I don't do a post now unless I'm worried about what people will think about me. So I struck a deal with him. I'd kept notes about what I'd learned, the practice, how I'd succeeded and failed. I would put those together in a book and send it over. If he liked it, I'd publish it. And that's how we ended up here. What is this about? Loving yourself. Same thing your mom told you. Same thing self-help books repeat enough times to be cliche. But there is a difference. It's not lip service. It's not a fire and forget type approach. It's something I learned from within myself. Something I believe saved me. And more than that, the way I set about to do it. Most of it, simple enough to be idiotic. But in simplicity lies truth. In simplicity lies power. Starting with the write-up I sent to my friend, this is a collection of thoughts on what I learned, what worked, what didn't, where I succeed and where I failed daily. As a wise friend likes to remind me, this is a practice. You don't go to the gym once and consider yourself done. Same here. Meditation is a practice. Working out is a practice. Loving yourself, perhaps the most important of all, is a practice. The truth is to love yourself with the same intensity you would use to pull yourself up if you were hanging off a cliff with your fingers, as if your life depended upon it. Once you get going, it's not hard to do. Just take commitment and I'll share how I did it. It's been transformative for me. I know it'll be transformative for you as well. Beginning. I was in a bad way, miserable out of my mind. There were days when I lie in bed, the drapes closed, morning outside sliding into night and back to morning, and I just didn't want to deal. Deal with my thoughts, deal with being sick, deal with heartache, deal with my company tanking, deal with life. Here is what saved me. I'd reached my breaking point. I remember it well. I couldn't take it anymore. I was done. Done with all this. This misery, this pain, this angst, this being me. I was sick of it. Done. Done, done, done. And in that desperation, I climbed out of bed, staggered over to my desk, opened my notebook, and wrote, "This day, I vow to myself to love myself, to treat myself as someone I love truly and deeply. In my thoughts, my actions, the choices I make, the experiences I have, each moment I'm conscious, I make the decision, I love myself." There was nothing left to say. How long it took me to write this? Less than a minute. But the intensity? It felt like I was carving words onto paper, through the desk. I'd been disgusted with myself. I could love another, but what about me? From now on, I would focus only on this thought, for me. How to love myself, I did not know. All I knew was that I'd made a vow, something far greater than a want or a desire, an I wish or a nice to have, a vow. I had to go all in or destroy myself trying. There was no middle ground. In my bedroom, in the darkness, with the city outside that had no idea of the decision that had been made, I set out to love myself. The way I did it, it was the simplest thing I could think of. And importantly, something I could do no matter how bad I was feeling. I started telling myself, "I love myself." A thought I would repeat again and again. First, lying in bed for hours, repeating to myself, "I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself." The mind would wander, of course, head down rat holes, but each time I noticed, I returned to repeating, "I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself." And it continued. First in bed, then showering, then went online. Then when I'd be talking to someone, inside my head, I'd be going, "I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself." It became the anchor, the one true thing. Then, I added anything that could work, and if it did, I kept it. If it didn't, I threw it away. Before I knew it, I'd created a simpler practice that took loving myself to a whole new level. I was all in. There was no going back. I got better. My body started healing faster. My state of mind grew lighter. But the thing I never expected or imagined, life got better. But not just better, things happened that were fantastically out of my reach, things I couldn't have dreamt of. It was as if life said, "Finally, you idiot, and let me show you that you made the right decision." People came into my life, opportunities arose, and I found myself using the word magic to describe what was happening. And through it all, I kept repeating to myself, "I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself." I kept doing the practice. In less than a month, I was healthy. I was fit again. I was happy. I was smiling. Amazing people were coming into my life. Situations were resolving themselves. And all that time, whether I was at my computer or in a meeting, in my head, I'd be telling myself, "I love myself." To be honest, in the beginning, I didn't believe that I loved myself. How many of us do? But it didn't matter what I believed. What mattered was doing it, and I did it the simplest way I could, by focusing on one thought again and again and again and again, until it was more on my mind than not. Imagine that. Imagine the feeling of catching yourself loving yourself without trying. It's like catching a sunset out of the corner of your eye. It will stop you. Why love? Why not I like myself, or I accept myself? Why, oh why, oh why does it have to be love? Here's my theory. If you've ever been a baby, you've experienced love. The mind knows it on a fundamental, even primal level. So, unlike most words, love has the ability to slip past the conscious and into the subconscious, where magic happens. What if you don't believe that you love yourself? Doesn't matter. Your role is to lay down the pathways, brick upon brick, reinforce the connections between the neurons. The mind already has a strong wiring for love. The body knows it as well. It knows that love nurtures, that love is gentle, that love is accepting. It knows that love heals. Your job is not to do any of these. Your job is purely to love yourself, truly and deeply. Feel it, again and again. Make it your single-minded focus. The mind and body will respond automatically. They don't have a choice. Here's the best part, one that makes me smile as I write this. As you love yourself, life loves you back. I don't think it has a choice either. I can't explain how it works, but I know it to be true. When you find yourself using the word magical to describe your life, you'll know what I'm talking about. The practice. I've tried to break down exactly what I did that worked and how one can replicate it. It comes down to four things that I will show you how to do. 1, mental loop. 2, a meditation. 3, mirror. 4, one question. All four gently return me to self-love. That's the beauty of this practice. It's simple, it's practical, and the results are far greater than you could imagine. After all, if you loved yourself truly and deeply, would you limit your life to what you previously thought possible? Nope. You blow your own socks off. There is one requirement, a fierce commitment to loving yourself. This, I'm afraid, can't be skipped. What if you don't believe that you love, or heck, even like yourself? Doesn't matter. If you have to build up to it, that's okay. The practice works in the way the mind is designed to function. The mind has no choice but to adapt and respond. Just remain open to the possibility of loving yourself. The rest is easy. Window. Darkness is the absence of light. If you remember this, it will change your life. Changed mine. It is this concept that the practice is based on. Any negative thought is darkness. How do you remove it? Do you fight fear or worry? Do you push or drown away sadness and pain? It doesn't work. Instead, imagine you're in a dark room and it's bright outside. Your job is to go to the window, pull out a rag, and start cleaning. Just clean. And soon enough, light enters naturally, taking the darkness away. It's that simple. Each time the mind shifts to darkness, fear, worry, pain, you name it. When you notice, clean the window. Light will flow in. 1. Mental loop. I sit at my desk. San Francisco sparkles through the large bedroom windows. A Coca-Cola sign blinks off, then rebuilds itself, one letter at a time. I see cars on Market Street, red taillights. The famous tower over Twin Peaks is swallowed up by the night, hidden by fog. If you were to open up my head at this moment and peer within, you'd find yourself asking with a thick, sudden drawl, does this boy not have an imagination? There's only one thought running through my head. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. For days, ever since I made the vow, this has been my only focus. Sometimes as a whisper, sometimes silent. When I brush my teeth, mumbling. In the shower, loud, non-stop. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. I have nothing to lose. This is all there is. I love myself. I love myself. I don't give a damn about anything else. I love myself. I once heard someone explain thoughts as this. We, as human beings, think that we're thinking. Not true. Most of the time, we're remembering. We're reliving memories. We're running familiar patterns and loops in our head. For happiness, for procrastination, for sadness. Fears, hopes, dreams, desires. We have loops for everything. We keep replaying the loops, and they, in turn, trigger feelings. It's automatic to the point where we believe that we have no choice. But that is far from the truth. Imagine a thought loop as this, a pathway laid down by constant use, like a groove in rock created by water. Enough time, enough intensity, and you've got a river. If you had a thought once, it has no power over you. Repeat it again and again, especially with emotional intensity, feeling it, and over time, you're creating the grooves, the mental river. Then it controls you. And that is why a focused mental loop is the solution. Take this one thought, I love myself. Add emotional intensity because it deepens the groove faster than anything. Feel the thought. Run it again and again. Feel it, run it. Whether you believe it or not doesn't matter. Just focus on this one thought. Make it your truth. The goal here is to create a groove deeper than the ones laid down over the years. The ones that create disempowering feelings. They took time as well. Some we've had since childhood. Which is why this requires a focused commitment. Why it must be a practice. Forget demolishing the grooves of the past. What you're creating is a new groove so deep, so powerful, that your thoughts would automatically flow down this one. It takes time, sure. It took me a month to go from misery to magic. But you will notice changes, shifts in your feelings, beautiful happenings in your life. Expect them. There'll be more and more until one day, you'll be walking outside in the sunshine, feeling good, loving life and life loving you back, and you'll stop and realize that it's now your natural state. Can you imagine a better way to be? 2. A meditation. Even if you don't do anything else, please do this. It will make a difference. Each day, I meditate for 7 minutes. Why 7 minutes? Because I put on a piece of music that I like, one that is soothing and calm, piano and flute, one that I associate good feelings with, and it happens to be 7 minutes long. I sit with my back against the wall, put on my headphones, listen to the music, and imagine galaxies and stars and the universe above, and imagine all the life from space flowing into my head and down into my body, going wherever it needs to go. I breathe slowly, naturally. As I inhale, I think, I love myself. Then I exhale and let out whatever the response in my mind and body is, whether there is one or not. That's it. Simple. Inhale, I love myself. Exhale, breathe out what comes up. Inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale. Natural. The music flows. The mind wanders. That's its nature. Each time it does, I just notice where I am in the breath. If inhaling, I shift to, I love myself. If exhaling, I shift to letting out whatever is in the mind and body. Occasionally, I shift my attention to the light flowing in from above. Sometimes, I do that each time I inhale. Before I know it, the 7 minutes are up and the meditation is over. There is something to this, the thought of light flowing into my head from galaxies and stars. The concept of light itself. Just like love, the subconscious is a positive association with light. Plants grow toward the light. As human beings, we crave light. We find sunrises and sunsets and a bright moon beautiful and calming. Once again, there's no need to consciously create healing or anything positive. The subconscious takes care of it. All I have to do is give it the image, in this case, light. Give it the thought, in this case, loving myself. It does the rest. This is an intense practice because it is focused. But does it feel intense? No, quite peaceful actually. I think that's what real emotional intensity is. One that creates peace and love and growth. Instructions. Step 1. Put on music, something soothing, gentle, preferably instrumental, a piece that makes you feel good. Step 2. Sit with your back against a wall or window. Cross your legs or stretch them out, whatever feels natural. Step 3. Close your eyes. Smile slowly. Imagine a beam of light pouring into your head from above. Step 4. Breathe in. Say to yourself in your mind, I love myself. Slowly. Be gentle with yourself. Step 5. Breathe out and along with it, anything that arises. Any thoughts, emotions, feelings, memories, fears, hopes, desires. Or nothing. Breathe it out. No judgment, no attachment to anything. Be kind to yourself. Step 6. Repeat 4 and 5 until the music ends. If your attention wanders, notice it and smile. Smile at it as if it's a child doing what a child does. And with that smile, return to your breath. Step 7. When the music ends, open your eyes slowly. Smile. Do it from the inside out. This is your time. This is purely yours. Why music? Since I listen to the same piece of music each time, it now acts as an anchor, easily pulling me into a meditative state. A crutch, perhaps, but a nice one. Do this meditation consistently. You will notice the magic that occurs. 3. Mirror. This one, I'm a little scared to share. People will think I've lost it, but it is powerful. Step 1. Set a timer for 5 minutes. Step 2. Stand in front of a mirror, nose a few inches away. Relax. Breathe. Step 3. Look into your eyes. It sometimes helps to focus on just one. If so, try your left eye. Breathe slowly, naturally, until you develop a rhythm. Step 4. Looking into your eyes, say, I love myself. Whether you believe it that moment or not isn't important. What's important is you saying it to yourself, looking into your eyes, where there is no escape from the truth. And ultimately, the truth is loving yourself. Step 5. Repeat I love myself gently, pausing occasionally to watch your eyes. When the 5 minutes are up, smile. You've just communicated the truth to yourself in a deep, visceral way, in a way the mind cannot escape. If anyone ever looked in your eyes, knowing that you loved them, this is what they saw. Give yourself the same gift. 4. One question. It's easy to say I love myself while locked inside my apartment, recovering from being sick. Tougher when I'm back to the land of the living, interacting with people who have their own issues and mental loops. That is where the question came from. In dealing with others and reacting to their negative emotions with my own, I found myself asking this question. If I love myself truly and deeply, would I let myself experience this? The answer, always, was a no. It worked beautifully. Because I had been working on the mental loop, the step after no was clear. Rather than solving the emotion or trying not to feel it, I would just return to the one true thing in my head. I love myself. I love myself. I love myself. Discussion is deceptively simple in its power. It shifts your focus from wherever you are, whether it's anger or pain or fear, any form of darkness, to where you want to be. And that is love. Your mind and life have no choice but to follow. Thought. If we are made of atoms and molecules, and they in turn from smaller particles that are empty space and energy, then what are we? Are we our thoughts? Ever catch your mind in a mental loop, replaying some old story, an old hurt, the same pattern? Who are you? The thought or the observer of the thought? If you're the observer, then what is the thought? Or are you a thought observing another thought? Perhaps we're just biochemical storms within synaptic connections in a brain that evolved over millions of years. Or maybe there's an observer, a deeper self. No proof either way. I'm fine with not knowing. I enjoy thinking about it, but mainly to remind myself that ultimately, everything is theory. I care about what works, what creates magic in my life. This, I know. The mind, left to itself, repeats the same stories, the same loops, mostly ones that don't serve us. So what's practical, what's transformative, is to consciously choose a thought, then practice it again and again, with emotion, with feeling, with acceptance. Lay down the synaptic pathways until the mind starts playing it automatically. Do this with enough intensity over time, and the mind will have no choice. That's how it operates. Where do you think your original loops came from? The goal, if there is one, is to practice until a thought you chose becomes the primary loop, until it becomes a filter through which you view life. Then practice some more. Sounds like work? Perhaps. But the nature of mind is thought. Choose one that transforms you, makes your life zing. The one I found, I love myself, is the most powerful one I know. You might discover another. Regardless, please do it. It is worth it. Memory. Memory is not set in stone. Any neuroscientist will tell you that. The more you remember something, especially if it's emotionally charged, the more you will reinforce the pathways connecting the neurons. Simply put, the more you think about it, the more you feel it, the stronger the memory. Here's the interesting part. It's not just the act of recall that strengthens a memory. Another factor shapes and even changes it. The state of mind you're in when remembering something. The implications of this are transformative. Take a random experience, a relationship that ended years ago. Consciously recall it when you're miserable. You'll find yourself focusing on the negative parts, and those will grow stronger in memory. Conversely, same exact experience, but recall when you're happy. Notice the change? It's still the same experience. It's still your mind. But the filter is different, and the filter shifts the focus, which subtly changes the memory. More importantly, it changes how the memory makes you feel, the power it has over you. There's a solution here, a powerful one. If a painful memory arises, don't fight it or try to push it away. You're in quicksand. Struggle reinforces pain. Instead, go to love. Love for yourself. Feel it. If you have to fake it, fine. It'll become real eventually. Feel the love for yourself as the memory ebbs and flows. That will take the power away. And, even more importantly, it will shift the wiring of the memory. Do it again and again. Love, rewire. Love, rewire. It's your mind. You can do whatever you want. Light switches. Richard Bandler, co-creator of NLP, became known early in his career as someone who could cure schizophrenics within hours. He started getting called by doctors and patients' families to go to mental institutions to work with the worst cases, the ones everyone had given up on. One of his favorite stories is about an executive who started hallucinating snakes. No one could convince him otherwise. He was committed, received treatment, no luck. So he was strapped to his bed. Not very empowering when you believe snakes are crawling all over you, in the mental hospital, and chalked off as one of the incurable ones. By the time Bandler met him, he was in bad shape. To figure out what to do, Bandler went for a walk in town. He needed to snap this guy back to reality. He passed a pet store and noticed a barrel full of rubber snakes on the curb. He went inside, asked the man behind the counter if he could rent the entire barrel for a few hours. "They're for sale," the man said. "I don't rent the whole barrel." "I need them," Bandler said, "all, but only for a few hours." "Why?" "I'm going to cure schizophrenia," Bandler said. "Cool," the man said. Bandler chalks it up to the fact that since the store owner wasn't a doctor, his mind was open to cures that were out of the norm. Turns out he also had a few well-trained snakes, two cobras and one giant python that loved wrapping herself around humans. Perfect. The store owner and Bandler returned to the mental hospital, bags full of rubber snakes and three real ones, went to the shower where the patient bathed, and covered the place with them. The live cobras, he put extra close to where the patient would be. The python, right above where he had positioned the wheelchair. Finished, he surveyed his work. It reminded him of the scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark, where Indiana Jones descends into a chamber full of writhing snakes. Enough to scare anyone, let alone a person with heightened snake phobia. Keep in mind, Bandler once cured a guy who thought he was Jesus by bringing three muscular football players dressed as Roman centurions and wood for a life-size cross into his hospital room. Then, proceeded to nail the cross together, pausing occasionally to measure the guy as the centurions held him down. By the time they were ready for the crucifixion, the man was convinced he wasn't Jesus. Even after the drama had passed, the cure stuck. The snake owner and doctor stood behind the one-way glass to the shower. Bandler brought the man in, strapped tight in his wheelchair. The moment the man saw the snakes, he started screaming, "Snakes!" It was a terrible sound, Bandler says, from the very depths of the man, carrying throughout the hospital, "Snakes!" But it positioned the man right where he could see the cobras in front and the python dangling above. Then he left and shut the door behind him. The man screamed and screamed. Bandler waited. Finally, he went in. The man saw him, was about to scream, but Bandler cut him off. "Snakes, snakes, yes I know," Bandler said. "Tell me which ones are real and which ones aren't, and I'll wheel you out. Otherwise, I'm leaving you in here." Then he turned to go. "Rubber snakes," the man said, motioning to the ground with his head. "Hallucinated snakes," he motioned around. Then, eyes up at the python dangling a few feet above, dropping closer, "Real snake." This caught Bandler off guard. The man, when put to the test, was not only lucid enough to distinguish real from hallucinated, he could even tell which ones were rubber, something Bandler had a hard time telling, given how realistic they were. He wheeled the man out and asked him how he could tell hallucinated versus real. "Easy," the man said. "Hallucinated snakes are see-through." The man had known all along. Reality was solid. Hallucinations were see-through. But his fear was so intense, he'd lost touch with reality. Bandler taught the man to focus on the difference between reality and hallucinated see-through snakes, and the man was cured. He still saw hallucinated snakes occasionally, but knew that they were not real. The power they had over him was gone. Fighting fear doesn't work. It just drags us in closer. One has to focus on what is real, on the truth. When in darkness, don't fight it. You can't win. Just find the nearest switch, turn on the light. James Altucher, in one of his best blog posts, talks about how he stops negative thoughts in their tracks with a simple mind trick. "Not useful," he tells himself. It's a switch, a breaker of sorts, shifts the pattern of the fear. In the last book of the Hunger Games trilogy, one of the main characters has been tortured by the Capitol, his memories altered so that he can't distinguish between actual and implanted memories. His friends come up with a simple exercise. They tell him memories they know to be true, then ask, "Real or not real?" Slowly, he learns to distinguish real from not real until his mind adapts and he realizes that not real memories have a certain shininess to them. And when in doubt, he returns to the practice, real or not real. Fear, when used properly, is a useful tool. It serves us well when near a blazing inferno or standing at the edge of a cliff. But outside of this, it hijacks the mind, to the point where it's difficult to distinguish the mind and our thoughts from fear itself. So, these tools, like light switches, exist. When fear arises, remember that it is a hallucinated snake, or that it's not useful, or that it's not real. All three work. There's many more, ones we can come up with ourselves, if we wish. As long as it works, it's valid. Key is this: when in darkness, have a light switch you've chosen standing by. For example, in writing this book, fear says that I'm risking what people will think of me. Doesn't matter. My role is to recognize it for what it is: hallucinated snake, not useful, not real, and continue on. I'm in love. You're so pretty, I say. She walks alongside my friend, Gabe, holding his hand. Her dark hair freshly cut, layers. Cool February night in the Mission District in San Francisco. We're heading for tacos. I'm in love, she says. We pause to cross the street. It's true, she says. That's why. I'm in love. She's pretty regardless, but I get what she's talking about. She glows, nonstop smile, full of life. When I get home, before I go inside, I pause and realize something. The love, it doesn't have to necessarily be for another, does it? Love is an emotion. Love is a feeling. Love is a way of being. That spring in the step, that smile, that openness, can it simply come from loving ourselves? That stops me. Of course. Here we are, thinking that one needs to be in love with another to shine, to feel free and shout from the rooftops. But the most important person, the most important relationship we'll ever have is waiting, is craving to be loved truly and deeply. And here's the interesting part. When we love ourselves, we naturally shine. We are naturally beautiful. And that draws others to us. Before we know it, they're loving us, and it's up to us to choose who to share our love with. Beautiful irony. Fall in love with yourself. Let your love express itself, and the world will beat a path to your door to fall in love with you. Forgiveness. I drive down Highway 1, top down, looking for the trees. Half a mile south of the lighthouse in Pescadero, I see the familiar fence separating the meadow from the road. I pull over and turn the car off. The engine slowly clicks into silence. Then I grab my day pack, hop the fence, and hike toward the trees. The breeze ripples through the brush as I walk. At the far edge is the open Pacific. Big blue summer sky above. I discovered this meadow when I first moved to California. I'd get in my car and just drive and drive. Amazed by the massive beauty of the Pacific Northwest. There's nothing in the world quite like it. Years ago, I brought a girlfriend here. When we reached the trees, I tore out a piece of paper from my notebook, handed her a pen. You need to forgive yourself, I said to her. She still carried guilt from her divorce. It was time for her to let it go. Write down whatever you're holding against yourself, I said. Everything. Then forgive yourself. Write that down, too. When you're done, you're going to give this paper to the ocean. It'll set you free. She was quiet for a long while. I think she might have cried a little. You have to forgive yourself, too, she said, for not going to medical school. One amazing thing about women, their wisdom. She was right. I chose startups over a career in medicine, and no matter what story I told myself, it was a selfish choice. Of money over doing something that mattered to me, a choice I hadn't come to terms with. So we both worked on our letters, then we hiked down to the waves, balled up the papers, and threw them into the ocean. And you know what? It worked. Something released inside, and I never looked back. The regrets about giving up a med school went away, on their own. So simple, this exercise. Here I am at the Grove, once again, this time alone. Only two windswept trees left. The third lies across the grass, the long trunk charred. Lightning strike, perhaps. A shorter trunk sits a few feet apart, bleached white by the wind and rain. I climb it and stare out at the ocean. Early evening. The sun is high and large. The water below it, all the way to the horizon, shimmers a path of gold. I pull out my notebook from my day pack, tear off a piece of paper, and write. Today's date, what I'm holding against myself, for screwing up when I knew better, for closing my heart, for hurting more than I needed to, for the mistakes, everything. Finished, I write that I forgive myself, for it all. And in that moment of forgiveness, I write that I'm clean and pure, because I know I am. That is the first step. There are two more left. Life has taught me this much in the time between when I first discovered this grove and today. I hike down to the beach, sit on a rock, and watch the waves. They crash and crinkle over the pebbly shore. I raise the letter to the sky and read it out loud. all that I hold against myself, all the forgiveness. I repeat this until it's not needed anymore. Then I reach behind me and grab a large pebble. When I see it, I laugh. It's shaped like a heart. Ah, life, you do have a sense of humor. I fold the paper tight around the stone heart, stare at the waves again. This is a sacred moment of giving over all that I held against myself to something bigger, for it to do what it may, for it to take away from me so that I may unburden myself, so I may live the life I'm meant to live. After all, it's the things we hold against ourselves that weigh us down more than anything. When the moment feels right, I throw the rock high in an arc into the water. It splashes in a quick plop, then it's gone. The waves rush over and around it. That easy. I watch for a while, wondering if the water will return it to me. It doesn't. I hike back up to the grove, sit on the trunk again, and pull out the notebook. This time, I write a different letter to myself, short and to the point. Dear Kamal, I vow to love you fully and completely and deeply in every way, in all thoughts, in all actions, in all my desires and my being. I vow to love you, Kamal. I sign and date it. I put the notebook down, stare out at the sun. It's moved halfway down the sky. The wind shimmers through the tall brown grass. It's getting chilly. I throw on my jacket, take it all in. Then, back to my notebook, and I read out aloud my vow to myself from a clean and pure place. This, my starting point. It feels beautiful. It feels, well, it feels right. That's how you know when you've hit it, when it feels right. No one can teach you this. You just have to do it. And the more you do, the more you develop a trust in this feeling, the more you listen to it, the more you live it. And this transforms your life. Choice. If there's one thing in life I excelled at, it was getting in my own way. If they ever held an Olympics for it, I swear I'd bring home the gold. It was as if, as soon as things were going well, I'd find a way to create the biggest obstacle I could find and fall flat on my face. The pattern served to help keep me unhappy, to definitely not having loving thoughts about myself. Each time, I tell myself that I learned my lesson. I'd get up, dust myself off, start running, gain speed. Life was going good, too good. So, of course, the old patterns grew seductive and, well, splat. You get the idea. I don't know why I did this. Maybe childhood stuff, maybe adult stuff. I suppose knowing the reasons help, but in the end, the only thing that matters is the life I live, the results. Here's one that happened when I started to love myself. I noticed my patterns. I had no idea I even used to do this. I just thought it was my life. They didn't disappear right away, but I was aware of them. And that was the start. Going forward, each time I got in my way, it was no longer unconscious. It was a choice. And eventually, I grew tired of those choices. That's the thing about loving yourself. You start to tolerate less what doesn't serve you, especially from yourself. This alone changes your life. Here's what I've learned about habits and patterns that don't serve us. There is a moment of decision where two paths stretch out in front. One choice calls for the old familiar, the other, unknown. Magic lies in the unknown. Asking the right question is the most powerful tool I've found in choosing the path to magic. In that moment, when I'm about to repeat an old pattern, make a familiar and comfortable mistake, I pause, breathe deep, let the life flow in, and ask myself, if I love myself truly and deeply, what would I do?